The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Every year or so, I talk to the man you see there on the Zale News Channel, James Patterson. I'm going to talk with him today about his brand new book, Walk the Blue Line. They walk the line between life and death with Matt Eversman. Good morning, James. Welcome back. Congratulations, another page turner. Give us the story behind the book. How did you come to decide to write this?
Yeah, what Matt and I, we had done one on soldiers and we did one on ER nurses. And our mission is always the same at the end of it with respect to cops. If you've served, if you're a law officer, if you're out there dealing with the public every day in some dangerous situations, you'd say Eversman and Patterson got it right. And for a lot of other people, they'll go, I didn't really understand cops at all. And I think that's the main thing here. Most people on the left and the right, they really don't understand. And what this book does is just peels it away and shows you on the inside. And here's what cops have to go through day in and day out. It's
now,
not
all
pro
of these
cop,
stories, they come in different sizes, different shapes, both genders, every state. It's all over the place. And it's so compelling. So I picked my favorite and I want you to tell it. My favorite story is James McSorley in the Hollywood Hills. Maybe it's because I've spent a lot of time in the Hollywood Hills over my life. Maybe it's because we got Detective Tom from Oakland who calls in every now and then. Tell people McSorley and his very...
You need to tell the stories because I can't remember the names and who did what.
He is the detective who goes
9 months
to the
ago.
Dentist.
Some of them I do and some of them, you know.
He is the detective who goes to the dentist and finds out that the dentist, or the dermatologist, and finds out that his dermatologist was inspired to go into medicine by virtue of a doctor on whose case McSorley had worked in a brutal double murder by a maniac on a rampage in the Hollywood Hills. And it's the weirdest coincidence in a book full of inspiring stories, but that was weird.
Well, that one could be a novel.
Yes.
Just in itself, yeah. Some are complex like that. Some are very simple. Some just give you a notion. One of the law officers arrives at one of these scenes and the people in the neighborhood are going, you don't care about us. And he stopped. He said, if I didn't care about you, why would I be here in the teeming rain at 4 a.m? You know, just a lot of it where it just brings it home to people in terms of, and some of the stuff is, some's very violent. There's more action in this than there are in a couple of Alex Cross books. But some of the stories are very, very heartfelt and warm. I have a little cold, so I'm a deeper...
You sound great, James.
Better, probably.
I'm going to read something from Walk the Blue Line. And you didn't number the chapters. It's just a name. Sean Patterson comes towards the end of the book. I walk into the mayor's house. I'm 27 years old, the son of a preacher. When I was a kid, especially as a teenager, I got into all sorts of trouble. One of the cops knew my father and chewed my butt out. Afterwards, he took me out on ride-along, out to lunch and dinner. We played football together. He tried to set my life on the right path, and that's what I realized. Wow, cops are human beings with families and real emotions. They actually care about other people. It kicked off a chain of events that led me into a police reserve program and now here to the mayor's office. That's what this book does, James. It introduces us to policemen and women who we don't know anything about them.
Yeah. No, and it does humanize. And some people actually criticize us for humanizing cops, which is so absurd. We did one interview, and I think the woman was trying to be nice, but she said, I realize that half the cops are good guys and good men and women. And I go like, what? What do you mean half the people? Yes, there are a few that aren't, but for the most part, they're out there trying to do their best. And what people don't realize, and you will get from this book, is just people know how dangerous the world is, kind of. But they don't understand how dangerous it is for these men and women going out there and strapping on their body armor every day. And, when the military, and Matt knows this, Matt Eversman, my partner, you go into Mogadishu, which he did, or Kabul or Baghdad or whatever. And nobody blames the soldiers for the mess. Okay, they're in there and they just have to deal with it. And unfortunately, now a lot of people, they blame the mess on the police. You know, we didn't interview anybody from Memphis, as it turned out. But we did from a lot of the southern detectives we talked to, different police. Memphis came up, and people just said, oh, there are parts of Memphis that are just unbelievable. They're so bad. And that's a big part of the story here. That doesn't excuse bad action.
But no, it doesn't. This is not an apologia for every cop who's done everything ever wrong. This is the bell curve of police. And there's a best policeman in the United States, and there's a worst.
But the thing of, and this comes up again and again and again, every person we spoke to said that they totally were appalled by what happened in Minneapolis. Every single one of them. This is not the way cops, this is not the way they want to act. This isn't the way they do act for the most part. It does happen. We just had the 7th murder of a cop just this weekend at Temple University, and those stories don't get told. We just need to balance this thing more so that people understand. And that we need to be, we've gotten to the point with the military, thank you for your service, we have to do that with the police.
And, the fallen officers are always taken care of by my colleague, Mike Gallagher. He always goes and raises money for the families of the fallen. It's such a dangerous business. And that's Walk the Blue Line. The subtitle is They Walk the Line Between Life and Death. I think you conveyed, and Matt convey, they don't have any idea what they're going to go to work. I mean, every single moment of every single day is different.
Yes. And people don't realize, I've done a lot of ride-alongs, but Matt and I did a ride-along during this, and a couple of things came out. One was the sheriff said that in that county, they had over 1 million calls for help the previous year. So the volume is just unbelievable. And every time you go out, you're going to somebody's house, you're banging on a door, you're stopping a car, it's dangerous. You just don't know what's going to happen. The other thing that he talked about a lot of things, but one of them was that they have these ranges where they'll go and the police will get used to where they have to make a decision in 2 or 3 seconds. Every time they put a citizen in that situation, they went, I have no idea. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you make those life and death situations.
I wanted to make sure that people heard this.
Decisions.
Tim O'Brien is one of the officers you interview. Quote, I have 4 kids and they all drive. I tell them, listen, you're going to get tickets. It's going to happen. It sucks. Maybe you'll get lucky, but if I ever hear that you're disrespectful or a wise ass or anything like that, you're going to wish they towed your car. Your mother and I won't put up with it. And, it's just such common sense advice, James Patterson.
I don't know about you, but I hear people talking now like, well, we have to give the talk to our kids about the police. I got to talk when I was a kid. You don't mess around with the police. They're there. They're mostly doing a good job. They have guns and they have nightsticks, and you just don't. That's the talk, and we all got it. People think it's like some wild thing now that people get the talk.
James, tell me about if you've had blowback, because this is a pro police book, not because you're uncritical of the police, but because you tell the stories of men and women who are very admirable. So, have you gotten blowback about it?
Yeah, there is some. As I say, some people will criticize the book for humanizing the police. And as I've said to you, it's not all pro. There are some cowboys in here. You're doing some stuff that's like, no, you can't do that. And, but they do. The other thing which is interesting is Jake Tapper finally had me on the other day, but we could not get onto a lot of the channels. We're on Fox a lot, which is understandable. But could not get on to MSNBC and some of these things. And they need to hear this. You can't, how can you write about, how can you communicate about, how can you make judgments about in Congress? They need to read this book, in my opinion, because for the first time, a lot of people, you will understand what cops go through. You understand how difficult it is. With the military now, they're treating PTSD better than they ever have. That's not happening in most police departments still. That needs to happen.
You know, James, I hadn't thought of the parallel between the military and the police. I hadn't until just this morning. But in fact, that's very persuasive. And when you take the American military, it's a million strong. There's a best soldier, sailor, airman, and marine, and there's a worst soldier, sailor, airman, and marine. And there's a bell curve of excellence that generally pervades the service. There's a bell curve of excellence in American policing. I'd rather be policed by our police force than any other police force in the world. Because if I need a lot of help, do you agree with me on that?
Oh, totally. And they will say, you know, here are these neighborhoods and, you know, they're getting getting a lot of, you know, people spit in their face. It's ridiculous, except when they need help. And all of a sudden, you know, it's 911, which is okay. I mean, but the neighborhoods and the neighborhoods that need the police. I mean, one of the things, obviously, with the defund, and all of a sudden these neighborhoods are going like, no. We want the police here. We want them to be better. That's okay. Virtually every police officer we spoke to, we talked to beat cops, we talked to detectives, we talked to DEA, we talked to FBI, and all of them, kind of welcome that. Yeah, we can get better, we can train better. They don't need less money; they need more money to train better. And now they're losing a lot of cops. A lot of cops are just saying, "I can't put up with this anymore. I'm out."
Patterson, I think this will fly off the shelves, and not for political reasons, but because most Americans genuinely want to understand. I'm a veteran of
MMA. Political.
It isn't political.
It should not be. This is not a political. It shouldn't be, though. That's crazy. Yeah. That's one of the problems we have with the country now. This is not a political book, and it shouldn't be.
And you should be on every channel because you're James Patterson. How many books have you sold? Like 150 million books? I have no idea.
I don't know.
In that regard, Ken Follett comes on with me whenever he puts out a book. You do too. And I always tell young authors or third or fourth time, the hardest working guys I know in the writing business are Ken Follett and James Patterson because they promote every book like it's their first book. Why do you do that?
Well, in this case, because I believe in this book, I think it's one of the most, this whole series, Walk in My Combat Boots, ER Nurses in this one, I just think they're important because you will understand something you thought you understood, but you didn't understand. And I think that's useful. The Jeffrey Epstein was also valuable, I think, to because we were one of the first to really bang at that story back in 2016.
Yeah, more is coming out, that's too. Why are you going to go back and update the Epstein book? Because more is going to come out, I guess, this week.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So are you done with this series, James Patterson? Are you going to go back to novels?
We're going to do teachers.
Oh.
We're going to do teachers. And we're also doing, which is kind of a cute one, we're doing librarians and booksellers. It won't be quite as big an operation, but it's fun. And I have a fun title for it, which I think the librarians and booksellers will get a kick at. The title on that one's going to be The Secret Life of Librarians and Booksellers. The Secret Lives.
Well, you're going to have a million signings to go to. James Patterson, I'm going to let you go, but let me ask you, are you an optimist about this country after you've written about nurses and cops and soldiers and you're writing about librarians and booksellers? Are you, James Patterson, an optimist?
I am. And as bad and as crazy as things are now, and they're crazier now because we're hearing, because of the internet, we hear about every crazy thing that happens and it gets picked up. You know, Congress has always been nuts. I mean, you know well enough. There were, you know, for years, there were drunks rolling around. Nobody knew. There were people who were incoherent senators. But the stories just weren't all over the place. Now we just hear about everything and it's scary. But I think in general, life is better than it's ever been in a lot of ways. I mean, there's some major issues here, but I think we actually have improved a whole lot of things.
Well, let me come out of left field. I've been talking for 2 days about President Biden's best day of his presidency. He goes to Kyiv. I think it's the best day of a beleaguered president. What do you think of the world? I mean, between China, Russia, and Iran, we have three very serious enemies who would not let a James Patterson write his books, tell his stories. What do you think of the balance of conflict in the world?
I think it's more dangerous than it's been in a while, but we've been through it. You know, like we went through Vietnam, we went through, you know, the Kennedy years, with Cuba. So we've been through some hairy stuff in the past. People kind of forget about that, you know, but yes, it is hairy now. I can't imagine on some level Russian or China actually wanting to get into a world war. I think they do realize that that's, suicidal. Maybe, I don't know. I hope.
I pray you're right. And I pray every American who sees a policeman will have read Walk the Blue Line before they do and before they engage. Boy, the book will actually stop a lot of problems from happening, James, if we understand our police and our police get to tell their story as they do in Walk the Blue Line. Congratulations on another bestseller. Keep coming back when your next one comes out. Thank you, James. America, bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt live in Studio West on this, the 21st day of February in the year of our Lord, 2023. Vladimir Putin has just delivered the State of the Nation speech in Moscow a day after President Biden's surprise visit to Kyiv in Ukraine and before President Biden speaks in Poland. The Russian dictator claimed this morning that they started a war. That's a direct quote. They, the West, started a war, and we use force and continue to use it to stop it. Throughout the speech, Putin blames us, the West, you and me, everyone listening to this show, for forcing him to invade Ukraine and butcher thousands of people and spend the lives of tens of thousands of Russians and Ukrainians, kidnap thousands of children and take them back to the... All that he has done, he is blaming on you and me. It's sort of remarkable. The reverberations of Joe Biden's trip to Ukraine and of the speech today continue to thunder across the country and will be the topics of conversation across tables all throughout the day in the United States. How Joe Biden swept into Kyiv on a train from Poland amid a cloak of secrecy, writes The Telegraph this morning. Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, former prime ministers of Great Britain, speaking on the occasion of the president's speech, rose in Parliament to demand fighter planes be sent to Ukraine. And on it goes. Former ambassador and national security advisor Robert O'Brien appeared on Fox with Martha McCollum yesterday to explain the American interests in the war in Ukraine. It's the best summary I found anywhere. Cut number 7.
Well, Martha, here's what we've seen happen. The Chinese humiliated us with a trek across the United States over multiple days with a spy balloon. And it stopped and lingered over our nuclear sites, our silos. It stopped and lingered over the second leg of our triad, our Air Force bases with nuclear-capable bombers. And it then took a little stop by our sub-pens to see what was going on with our submarine force. So it was an embarrassment, and that balloons have been taken down forthwith as soon as we found out about it, probably as it entered American waters. The Chinese got away with it. And the only consequence is that Tony Blinken, instead of meeting with his foreign counterpart in China in Beijing, he met with Wang in Berlin or in Munich in Germany. So what was the consequence to the Chinese? So is there any wonder that they think they can get away with supplying lethal weapons to the Russians for their fight against Ukraine? And by the way, General Kellogg was absolutely right. You know, we've got to win this thing in Ukraine, and it's in America's interest to win it because China and Russia are unlimited partners. And if we can use the Ukrainians to totally degrade the Russian army and show that we can win one of these wars, that will deter Xi Jinping from invading Taiwan. So this is a very important fight in Ukraine, and it has serious implications with our relationship with China and what happens in Taiwan.
That is former President Trump's most successful and final national security advisor, Ambassador Robert O'Brien, who you've heard on this program many times. Senator Lindsey Graham, also on with on this week with Martha Raddatz, tried to explain this weekend about Putin and our interests. And I think it's important for Americans to continue to discuss and understand why we are pursuing this policy. Cut number 6.
I don't know. You know, a year ago, everybody here was in denial. I was preaching as loud as I could. Putin really means it. Here's the good news. I've never seen NATO so united. The Germans have stepped up to the plate. There's bipartisan support for winning this war in Ukraine, for giving the Ukrainians the weapons they need to defend themselves. I'm not worried about provoking Putin. I want to beat him. And how do you beat him? You beat him by giving the Ukrainians the military capability to drive the Russians out of Ukraine. You label Putin's Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. You create international tribunals so we actually can try Putin and his cronies in an international court like we did after World War II. Don't worry about provoking Putin. Worry about beating him.
And I, that is the key thing. So last night I went on Special Report. And I know that in the Republican Party, there's a good 25 to 30% and not a few leading figures who are very, very leery of more aid for Ukraine. And I'm not among them. I believe wholeheartedly in giving the Ukrainians what they need. Give them the tools. They will finish the job. So Brett Baer had the panel on last night. And of course, we began with the president's surprise visit to Ukraine. And he turned to me and asked me what I thought about it, cut number 11.
Hugh, what do you make of the trip and reaction to it?
I think it's the best day of a beleaguered presidency by a lot, Brett. I think it's a significant historical moment, and all praise to the president for doing it. I was telling my radio audience this morning, I am reminded of not President Bush going to Iraq or President Obama making his trips or President Trump, but actually in 1940, FDR, who couldn't travel, sent Harry Hopkins in January of 41 to spend 2 weeks with Churchill in war-torn and bombed-out London. And at the end of it, Churchill told, or Hopkins told Churchill from the Book of Ruth, "Whither thou goest, I goest, and your people are my people." Churchill wept. So for the people of Ukraine, this could not have come at a better time, and it's got to be the greatest morale booster for them possible. So great thumbs up to the president for doing it today.
And so, some Republicans immediately jumped on me, and some of the conservatives who are against funding aid to Ukraine attacked that. And that's fine. I understand there is a division. It's legitimate. I want people to understand, though, you can hold two thoughts. You can be very, very critical of Joe Biden, especially his complete abandonment of East Palestine. But at the same time, support Ukraine. We did get around to that on the panel last night as well. Cut number 12.
Yeah. And what about that dichotomy, Hugh? Will it be striking? Will the former president try to bring that up? Because playing how Ukraine plays in the Republican primary will be a fascinating thing.
Well, the famous line is you can hold two thoughts. The administration's treatment of East Palestine, which is close to my heart, 40 miles from my hometown. It's a small town. It's 5,000 people. The East Palestine Bulldogs, the high school's under 300 kids. And they've destroyed the town. This train wreck has really hurt the town. And Pete Buttigieg hasn't been there, and you haven't seen the president there. And if he just touched down at Andrews and then got his way over to East Palestine, it would be another home run. But Donald Trump is very savvy in going up there because Ohio is Trump country. Columbiana County is Trump country. Indeed, that whole Pennsylvania-Ohio border is Trump country. And he's going to pay attention to the people that the Biden administration hadn't had time to. But you can praise the trip to Ukraine and absolutely blast the Buttigieg-Biden response in Ohio.
That's where I am. And I don't know if that's where you are. We took a lot of calls yesterday. We'll take more calls today. 1-800-520-1234. Let me begin by some other headlines. In the Washington Post this morning, rattled by China, U.S. and allies are beefing up defenses in the Pacific. We are in a great power struggle, like Cold War 2.0, and Americans are waking up to it. China is, by the Chinese Communist Party, is clearing the decks. Another of their top businessmen has been disappeared. Bao Fan, who is really one of the great investment bankers of China, has been banished. By Xi Jinping and the totalitarian state there. There's been more tremors in Turkey, by the way, and Secretary of State Blinken was there yesterday meeting with President Erdogan, standing by the people of Turkey. And I hope he was counseling him to get out of the way of the Sweden and Finland application for NATO. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is headed to East Palestine tomorrow, and Ron DeSantis was in New York City yesterday giving a speech about crime and punishment in the United States. The Wall Street Journal notes that Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis to court big money donors at dueling Palm Beach events. Look, the campaign is underway. Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis and Mike Pompeo and many, many others. Former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, current Texas Governor Greg Abbott, I think Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina and others will be in this race, I think, by the start of it on the debate side in July or August of this summer. And it's going to be just wide open and wild and full of interesting people saying important things. Cut number 13, if you would, Dwayne, from last night's special report.
We're back with our panel. Hugh, he said as much. He's put out statements on Truth Social saying the more the merrier when Nikki Haley got in. You've talked to the former president. Where's his mindset?
I think he's looking forward to a large stage full of combative would-be presidents about whom he's willing to compare and spar with. Governor DeSantis does have that book you mentioned, Brett, coming out, The Courage to be Free. That follows memoirs by Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Pompeo and Ambassador Haley. I expect Chris Sununu to get in. It's going to be a very talented field, but Donald Trump knows how to work a debate stage and how to work a Republican primary. I think everyone else has got pretty good media chops, too. You've interviewed them all. You know that. Ron DeSantis going to New York today, as you reported earlier, getting hit by Eric Adams. That's kind of a gift from Eric Adams to Ron DeSantis. I think he wants to go to every blue city and get
Stay tuned, America. More coming up on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. That music means David Drucker of The Dispatch joins me. David M. Drucker, there's so much going on, but I want to ask you the question I posed to Dwayne. If you had to guess how the Republican Party is split on continuing aid to Ukraine at the level at which it has existed presently and will continue to go, and on Joe Biden's trip to Kyiv, what do you think? What's the breakdown?
Well, I think that's a hard question to answer. Look, I think most elected Republicans, I say most, the majority, I mean, at least 50% plus one, but probably more than that, believe in continuing to fund the Ukraine effort and keep them stocked with weapons and money so that they can resist the Russian invasion. I do think there's a good 25 to 30%, around 25% of the party that's skeptical of it. And some of the louder, more prominent voices in the party are critical of the effort and have talked about winding it down. And I think that can lead the impression that the party isn't four square behind the effort. And it leaves, you know, a lot of questions as to what the next Republican president would do if this thing is still ongoing and there's a new Republican president in a couple of years. I have to think that the party supports the idea that President Biden went to Kyiv and is showing Vladimir Putin that we're not going anywhere.
Let me ask you about the trip itself. As I explained on Special Report last night, I think it's the best day of a bad presidency. So it's a low bar. It's been a terrible 25 months for Joe Biden in the country, but this was his best day. Some Republicans are mad at anyone saying anything good about Joe Biden, but, you know, the one thing he can do is show up. He can't give much of a speech and he can't give an interview, but he can show up. And he did the best that he can do, I think, as an infirm 80-year-old, which is show up in a war zone. What do you think?
Well, I think that whoever would have been president should have been doing two things once the Russians invaded. Do everything they can, short of U.S. troops, to help Ukraine resist the invasion, and show up on Ukrainian soil to show both the Russians and our allies that we're serious about ensuring that the Ukrainians resist the invasion and ultimately repel it. And that we're not going anywhere. And I think showing up when you're an American president is a hugely important symbolic move. We saw George W. Bush show up at different times during his presidency in different places. I remember once notably in Iraq.
Thanksgiving 2003.
These things are hugely important. They send a big message. The American president is unlike any other world leader. And so there's just no way to criticize it. You can criticize Joe Biden all day long for all sorts of things he's done or hasn't done, but I just don't see how there's anything negative about this.
So, David Drucker, let's wrap up by looking at what Governor DeSantis did yesterday, which was express skepticism about continuing to fund at this level, thereby suggesting a division in the party which could endure and deepen as we approach the debates. And we'll be healthy for the country to have this conversation, by the way. I welcome it, actually. I don't know where everyone on the Republican stage is going to come down on this, but it seemed to me that DeSantis is very sincere in this. And, you know, a combat veteran of Iraq, he is going to be very serious about this. How deep is the split in the announced candidate? Nikki Haley is all for the effort. Ron DeSantis is skeptical. Donald Trump is in between. I just don't have any idea how this is going to play in the primaries.
I'm not sure either, but I know that there are there's a significant portion of what we like to think of as the committed Republican voting base, right? And the populist wing of the party, which, you know, is over the past year has been ascendant, that are skeptical, not just of foreign intervention and sending American troops abroad, but spending American resources abroad. And they haven't seemed to put together the fact that how the United States handles the Russian invasion of Ukraine is going to have a direct impact on how China views American resolve vis-a-vis Taiwan and the Asia Pacific.
And do people think it's a skeptical of national security mattering in a presidential primary? I go back to the campaign for the 1980 nomination. Ronald Reagan became our nominee because of his opposition to the Panama Canal Treaty. A lot of other things. He won because Jimmy Carter was a terrible president. God bless the former president as he enters his last days on this earth. But I do think that Reagan won because he campaigned on national security embodied in the Canal Treaty. And I think we're going to see some Republicans campaign on national security embodied in aid to Ukraine. 1 minute, David.
Well, I think that's true, but I just think it depends on where the base shakes out. Look, the country in 1980 and the Republican Party, I think, was hungry for a voice that was going to oppose the Soviet Union aggressively and treat American resolve as something to buttress. And we've been in a place where the party's been split and less hawkish in certain elements of the party. And I think we'll see some of the candidates respond to those less hawkish voices as they look for advantage in a primary. I think the question is where they see the incentive structures writ large.
David M. Drucker on Twitter with The Dispatch, one of America's finest political essayists and observers. Thank you, David, for joining me. Byron York is going to come up after the top of the hour. Don't go anywhere, America. News, weather, and sports right ahead. Plus, much, much more on this Tuesday morning edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay tuned. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. Eric McTaxas's new book, Letter to the American Church, is a must-read wake-up call for American Christians on what needs to be done now and, in fact, needed to be done yesterday. Get Letter to the American Church. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live from the West Coast, recounting for you the continued after-effects of President Biden's trip to Kyiv yesterday, Vladimir Putin's just ridiculous speech this morning from the Kremlin about how the West made us do it. And joined now by Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News. Byron, good morning. What's your assessment of President Biden's trip and the aftermath?
Well, the word I hear used to describe the trip very often is symbolic. And I thought as a symbolic trip, I don't think it accomplished an enormous amount. I thought it was extraordinarily risky and a bad idea. I mean, the President Bush, Obama, and Trump's trips to Afghanistan and to Iraq were to countries where the United States was actually at war, that were just filled with United States military assets to assure that nothing bad would happen to the president. I thought this was obviously Ukraine is not that. And I thought it was risky and just did not accomplish an extraordinary amount.
Well, we agree that it is risky, but we disagree on what it accomplished. As I said to Brett Baer last night, I think it was the best day of a terrible presidency. Now, that's a low bar, Byron, but the impact it has on the Ukrainian people is enormous. The impact it has, I think, on Xi Jinping and Putin, maybe even Khamenei, in terms of reassessing what Biden will and will not do, is significant. And probably the best he could do, given his infirmity, his inability to communicate in speech or interview, the best thing he can do is actually walk around with Zelensky in the middle of Kyiv.
Well, I heard you, I think you mentioned Harry Hopkins.
Yes, 1941, January.
Yeah, the problem with that, of course, it's one of the steps that led to World War, to a global conflagration that left tens of millions of people dead. So, you know, you spoke about it in kind of a chipper way, and you thought, well, gee, I don't know if that's really the step I want to be on.
Well, let me make sure the audience, the war has not reached America in January of 1941. It has engulfed Europe for a year and a half, and the Battle of Britain was 5 months underway when Hopkins went to London.
Well, yes, but there was a big war not long after that. I mean, it was going on, but I mean, the United States got involved not long after that. So I just don't think that's the way to sell it to people who are skeptical.
Well, I'm not trying to sell it. I'm trying to describe its after effects. I'm selling it as in our national interest. And yeah. I'm going to have to talk to Senator Cotton and Molly Hemingway next hour, and they are on different ends of the Republican spectrum about this. How do you see that spectrum falling out, Byron? Where do you put the Republican Party in terms of percentages? Because I'm a hawk. I think this is great, and we should keep doing it. Give them the A-10s and the F-16s. Don't send send money and tools.
A couple of things to think about. One, I wrote about this last month. I think there was a Center for Strategic and International Studies report about the munitions that the United States has given Ukraine, and almost to the extent that we're kind of disarming ourselves to arm Ukraine, the number of javelins given to the Ukraine equals, since as of August of last year, equals 7 years of production. A million rounds of 155-millimeter howitzer ammunition, so much that we ran out of ammunition to give them, and sorry, give them 105 millimeters instead. So I think a number, and also at the same time, CSIS did a war game over a conflict over the Taiwan Strait and found that the United States would run out of some critical munitions within a week. So at a time when the United States doesn't have enough to defend itself, we're ramping up and trying to produce more to send to Ukraine. That said, when someone like Ron DeSantis and a lot of other Republicans, Kevin McCarthy and others, say they do not support a blank check for Ukraine, I'm sympathetic to that view, but I think you have to start saying, well, how big a check would you support? I mean, let's say it's reasonable to not support infinite arms transfers to Ukraine. How much do you support? Have we gone past where you support right now? Do you worry that we would go past the tanks or the F-16s in the future? What's your line? And I think people have a hard time kind of drawing a line, which is the nature of these things, because we now have this almost World War I-like conflict in Ukraine where they're just shooting artillery at each other, just using up mad amounts of munitions doing this, and there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of progress, so people are demanding that we escalate. Well, we got to give them the tanks, got to give them the F-16s. And so I think people who see danger in this process should draw a line somewhere and say, no, let's stop here.
And I think my argument is that there is more dangerous in allowing Putin to win, and he's not going to stop unless he's defeated. And Ron DeSantis made a very careful, calibrated comment because there are lots of problems with the Biden approach. Cotton talks about it all the time, Senator Cotton. Why are we doing these mincing step-by-step escalation? It is like LBJ in Vietnam, as opposed to trying and providing them with the weapons that will drive the Russians out but not carry the war into Russia. That's why the A-10 is different from the F-16 and why a HIMAR is not a tactical nuke. I mean, it all depends on what you're giving them and what your goal is. And I think what you landed on there, Byron, is what every Republican who wants to be president has to talk about now and anticipate where the war will be in 9 months, because it could be anywhere in 9 months, right?
Well, it could be in roughly the same place in 9 months. That's another possibility. And then that's the World War I aspect of it.
But on the debate stage, the Republican candidates, and they're all over the place, from Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley as hawks to Donald Trump, who goes back and forth, to Ron DeSantis, who's a Ukraine skeptic or persuadable, but leery of it. I don't know about Chris Sununu and Greg Abbott and everybody else who might jump in. It's a difficult, complicated problem. I would not let consultants drive my answers on this one, though. I don't think Ron DeSantis did. I don't think Trump is. This really gets to who you are as a person and how you view the West, I think.
Well, as far as the Republican base is concerned, you know, certainly the Trump supporting base, a lot of them will cite the fact that Trump didn't start any new wars as a reason for their support of Trump. So if those candidates are trying to appeal to that part of the base, then I'm not sure this Ukraine position is actually going to work. And I do remember covering the 2016 campaign extensively. Trump basically came out and said, you know, Iraq, the United States invasion and war in Iraq was just a total disaster, started as a mistake by George W. Bush. And you would have thought he was speaking to a conference of the nation or something. And yet it actually worked with a lot of the Republican base. So I think that there was kind of a post-Bush reckoning among some in the Republican Party about some of the sort of foreign entanglements gotten involved in. Now, do you think Ukraine, I'm not sure where they're going to come down on it.
Neither am I. I think you could devote an entire debate on national security, many debates on national security, the China-Russia-Iran axis, the best policy, how much to give where and how long we'll do it for. And the answer is you're really going to have to listen closely and find out who persuades Republican primary voters and the handful of independents who participate with them, because Reagan got the nomination on the Panama Canal and on opposing the Soviets with clear-eyed resolve. I think that heart still beats in the Republican Party, Byron York.
That was in the context of a Cold War that was just remarkably different from today's circumstances. And I've actually been thinking recently about the concept of what's called zombie Reaganism. I think it's still alive and well in the Republican Party. And as a matter of fact, I think the biggest issue, literally the biggest issue of the 2024 Republican race is there any going back? I mean, do people go back to a kind of Republicanism that existed from Reagan through Bush and McCain and Romney, or has Trump changed it so significantly that there's simply no going back? And I think foreign policy is going to be one of those areas.
Always, always perceptive. Byron York on Twitter and the Washington Examiner on Fox News. Thank you, Byron. Your phone call's coming up, 1-800-520-1234. Connect you to me, Hugh Hewitt. We're talking about Biden and Putin on Ukraine, the Republicans on Ukraine, and your opinions on Ukraine and American aid to it right here. Stay tuned. Friends, 2022 is history, but have you thought about what you will do in 2023? What will you do to make yourself better than last year? I have a challenge for you. Resolve to become a better educated citizen. Look, every year is a new opportunity, so I have a great way for you to make the most of this one. Our good friends at Hillsdale College have made their online courses free. They're all amazing, and they're free to all who wish to learn. My challenge to you, take just one. You can discover the beauty of the Bible in the Genesis story, study the writings of C.S. Lewis, or explore the true meaning of America in Constitution 101. There are many more to choose from, and these are all self-paced, free courses featuring Hillsdale faculty and scholars. So visit hughforhillsdale.com, that's HUGHFORHillsdale.com, and just pick one of the more than 30 free Hillsdale courses. I hope you accept my challenge. Pick whichever course you'd like and resolve to be a more educated American in 2023. Go to hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today. Welcome back, America. Bethany Mandel is one of my regular contributors. Good morning, Bethany. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I don't know where you are on Ukraine, but the Republican base is kind of split. Next hour, I'll have on Molly Hemingway and Tom Cotton, sort of the alpha and the omega of the Republican positions on Ukraine. Where's Bethany Mandel?
So I think I'm where a lot of Americans are, and semi-apathetic. And I think it's because we all have really short attention spans, that this has been going on now for a year. And I think a lot of Americans have sort of checked out a little bit. I enjoyed the back and forth that you had with a lot of callers, because I think ultimately the goal is victory. And at this point, it's low hanging fruit. We can kind of kick them when they're down. But I'm afraid that the majority of Americans don't care anymore because it's been going on for too long. And they've never had it explained beyond sort of talking points of this is the no boy thing to do. A lot of the Ukraine talking points sound a lot like COVID talking points, that it's been put into two black and white terms. And it's been sort of messaged as this is the noble thing to do, whereas people don't want to do what's noble. They want to do what's pragmatic. And I don't think that we've had a national conversation to explain to Americans, like, this is the threat that Russia poses, and this is why we're doing it for the sake of our national security. And we don't care about doing what's noble for Ukraine. That's not the objective here. We can't go and fight every single war in every single place in the world, but this specific conflict makes sense for us to get involved in a limited way. And we promise that it is in a limited way. And one of your callers sort of mentioned, you know, I think we're going to go in. And that speaks to a lack of trust from the Biden administration, because that trust has been broken on a million different things over the course of his presidency over the last 2 years.
As I said to Brett Baer last night, it was the best day of a terrible presidency. And when he went to Kyiv. And it is a terrible presidency, and that credibility problem, I mean, he collapsed in Afghanistan. This would not have happened had he not done that. So how does Neville Chamberlain get Munich back? You got to bring Churchill into your cabinet. And Joe Biden doesn't have the ability of, I mean, he can't message. But the best thing he could do was show up, because he can't talk. He can't persuade. He won't even give interviews, Bethany. The best thing he can do is just show up.
Yeah, and I think it was I think the point and the power of his visit isn't over here. I'm not sure how much people are paying attention over here, other than maybe being resentful that he's there and not in Ohio, because that's how Trump is messaging it. He's messaging it that, you know, Biden's in Ukraine while I'm in Ohio. But I think the power is in Ukraine. I think that people there are going to feel this balloon of confidence when they've been beat into submission, and, you know, the war crimes that have happened there are also not really talked about. But the last year has been horrifying for people in Ukraine. And I think that this gave them a lot of confidence to keep up the fight and to keep up the push. And I think that this is a story that will pass off the American radar in the next couple of days, but it won't in Ukraine.
You know, Bethany, I approach this with my grandchildren in mind. I think this is a horrible man, a true tyrant. And I think he's part of an axis of evil that really begins in Beijing, but extends to Khamenei in Iran and Putin in the Kremlin. Is the American people getting that? I mean, I don't even think it's a close call that this is in our interest.
I don't think the American people are getting that. And I think that, you know, you're right that the axis of evil starts in Beijing. And I've always been confused and concerned by the fact that Americans don't seem interested in the origins of how COVID started and China's involvement in any way. And I think that even sort of stepping back from conspiracy theories that, you know, are not probably conspiracy theories, but they knew a lot and they didn't do anything. And the level of anger that Americans should feel towards China is off the charts. I mean, they just destroyed our society.
The key there is should. We don't. Yeah, exactly. We should.
Exactly. And so if we don't understand the level of anger that we should have towards China, there's no way it will sink in when it comes to Russia.
Now, this is the challenge. And I know Joe Biden is just challenged. He can't give a speech. Kamala Harris is incoherent. There is Secretary Austin is invisible. Tony Blinken is uninspiring. It is the weakest national security team of my lifetime. Oh, well, at least since Carter. And I think Carter was better than this.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think that's a little too generous, but I don't want to crap on Carter right now.
Yeah, the last year of his presidency marked a turning point when he got over his, quote, inordinate fear of communism. Bethany Mandel, thank you as always. Follow her on Twitter, Bethany Shondark. Keep coming back, Bethany. Up next, Molly Hemingway joins me. She is on the skeptic end of the conservative spectrum about aid to Ukraine, followed by Senator Cotton, who's on the hawkish end, as I am, on aid to Ukraine. And we'll continue this conversation because, really, I don't think there's a more important conversation in America than this one. And the case has to be made, and President Biden can't make it. He did the best thing he could possibly do by showing up. And what Bethany just mentioned, the impact on the Ukrainian is the... effort is so profound and will endure even as Americans move on to their next controversy and political debate. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Coming up, Molly Hemingway, Tom Cotton, and hour number three of today's Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hugh, what do you make of the trip and reaction to it?
I think it's the best day of a beleaguered presidency by a lot, Brett. I think it's a significant historical moment, and all praise to the president for doing it. I was telling my radio audience this morning, I am reminded of not President Bush going to Iraq or President Obama making his trips or President Trump, but actually in 1940, FDR, who couldn't travel, sent Harry Hopkins in January of 41 to spend 2 weeks with Churchill in war-torn and bombed-out London. And at the end of it, Hopkins told Churchill from the Book of Ruth, "Whither thou goest, I goest, and your people are my people." Churchill wept. So for the people of Ukraine, this could not have come at a better time, and it's got to be the greatest morale booster for them possible. So great thumbs up to the president for doing it today.
Now, welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That is not by any means the uncontested majority opinion on the conservative side. Molly Hemingway is the opposite end of the spectrum from me, I think, and from my guest later in the hour, Senator Cotton. So I wanted to have on this morning people who may take a different view from me. Good morning, Molly. How are you?
Great. Great to be here with you.
I do want to get to Ukraine. I got to ask you first. You've blurbed a lot of books, right?
I have done my fair share.
I've done my fair share, too. I just sent an 1,100-word blurb. Have you ever done that to anyone?
No. No. That's impressive. I hope the book was worth it.
Oh, it is. It's Judge Thapar's book about Clarence Thomas. And I hate to gush, but I said to him, give this all to your publisher. Let him use 10 words or all 1,100. I don't care. I don't know what to do. You know what the problem is when you run into a great book.
Yes.
It is.
I don't know. What is it?
It's how to communicate that someone who's picking it up in a bookstore should read it. That's the art of the blurb.
For the blurb. So I actually did get to read an advanced copy of this, and I completely agree with you. This is a great book. And I also am already biased because I love Justice Thomas. But that is what I was kind of thinking was, I love this book. I would love other people to read it. And there were so many things to say about it. I actually kind of had the opposite problem. I didn't know where to go with it. And I should have just written 1,100 words to convey how great it is, how superb it is. How I kind of thought it was like two books in one, too, which I love for a Supreme Court book. You know, it's about Justice Thomas and his life. It's also about, you know, this originalist understanding that he has displayed in his opinions. But it's so readable and it's great. So I'm glad that you enjoy it, too.
I also think it's a third thing. As a con law professor, we always teach the cases. As a reporter and a journalist, we teach the headlines and the takeaways. But there are people involved. There are real people involved. And Judge Thapar brings Clarence Thomas's compassion for the real people to bear on these things.
Yes, I love and it. Really, I've always felt that about Justice Thomas, but he does a great job of showing that there are victims in all of these cases that need to have their wrongs righted.
It's justice. Now, Molly, let's get to Ukraine. I'm just going to give you the open forum. What did you think of the president's trip?
I definitely did not think anything along the lines of what you thought, and I don't really like, there are many problems I have with this kind of trip, and it really starts with just a disagreement about this approach to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which I think we all agree is a problem. I think the U.S. has been involved in this war without thinking strategically about what it wants to accomplish and what its involvement will do. I saw all these people complaining about if China were to help Russia by giving weapons, that would prolong the war. Well, that's true, and that's what we're doing. We're prolonging a war here. We have not been pushing for peaceful reconciliation. If he used this trip as a means to get everybody to the table to end this horrific war, I would be much more impressed, but I don't see that happening. It sounds like people just want to prolong things, spend money without a clear strategy, without an understanding of where we're going, and without any understanding of how it serves our national interests.
All right, now, Molly, I think it's a necessary step. The aid to Ukraine is a necessary step to stop the new axis of evil, which is anchored in Beijing and has an arm in Tehran and another arm in Moscow, and to stop the particular disaster that is the Ukrainian butchery from going forward. We got to defeat Putin. My end game is that the people in the Kremlin just have a Khrushchev day where all of a sudden Putin's gone. And that's my end game. And yeah, I don't think we get there any other way. And if Putin gets to the border, if he absorbs all of Ukraine, I think we're in, it's sort of like the Sudetenland followed by Czechoslovakia, followed by Poland in the 30s. You don't agree, obviously.
People who support this type of prolonging of this war kind of are all over the place. They went from saying we had to do this because otherwise he's going to take over all of Europe, which doesn't seem to match with how he even thinks in terms of whether he would go after an actual NATO country. But there's also the issue that we have seen in this war that the Russian army is not capable of doing that. That's actually one of the great things we've seen in this war. So I'm not so worried about that, but I am worried about further driving China and Russia together and Iran. You don't want to give them opportunity. It's like the opposite of the approach we took in the 70s, where we understood that we had to kind of work with China so that we could go after the Soviet Union. This, we're just driving them all together. We have not gotten the support of the world in this. It's what makes us weaker at a time that we should be stronger against China. We should be pivoting and thinking really about how we can take on this adversary, China.
Well, I can hold two thoughts. I can agree with the second thing you said and disagree profoundly with the first thing. But Molly, let's give each other a test. The best case against the Biden approach is that it's been incoherent and it's self-provocative. I know what the best case is against the approach he's pursued. What is the best case for his approach, Molly?
I would say, I don't know, the best case might be that he has shown some restraint. I mean, the big risk when you go to war with Russia is that they have 6,500 nuclear warheads. We've done a lot of arming and amplifying this effort, but we haven't gotten as far as to provoke a nuclear response. That might be the best I can say.
I think the best thing that can be said is that China has not yet gotten involved and that we've caused the Kremlin to reel backwards and that we could possibly win. But the worst part is that Biden, and now I want to go to my closing argument, Biden can't do anything else better than what he did yesterday because he can't talk, he can't persuade, he won't give interviews, he cannot deliver an effective speech. And his vice president is worse at it. His secretary of defense is a sphinx. And his secretary of state is unimpressive. I don't know that there's anything better he could have done than what he did yesterday.
So it was very theatrical. I don't actually think that Russians or Putin responds to theatrics. I don't think it actually affects that. I thought, like, for instance, that they had them, you know, the CNN was reporting that there hadn't been air raid sirens forever. Russia knew that Biden was there, but the air raid sirens go off a few minutes before Biden shows up, you know, very theatrical thing. Some people are very affected by that. I actually think U.S. foreign policy elites tend to be very affected by that more than anyone else. But I'm not sure. I think it's reckless. I mean, imagine if something happened when some of these high profile people are visiting Ukraine and we say we don't want to be drawn into a full on war with the nuclear power Russia. We say that we don't want that. We say that we don't want things to spiral out of control. But if something happens, some accident happens, some stray missile strikes while Jill Biden or Joe Biden or one of these top senators is there, this is very reminiscent of how World War One gets going. Not that people are actually trying to get into a world war, but a bunch of mistakes happen or a bunch of people making steps without thinking through what the consequences are. And that's the war. You know, everyone talks about World War Two as the thing we have to keep in mind, and Neville Chamberlain. But World War One is the other thing we should be keeping in mind about how horrific global conflict can break out because people are stumbling toward it.
Well, that's a fine cautionary reminder. I remind people of Harry Hopkins going to London in 1941 because the audience for this is not really Americans or foreign policy elite. The audience is the Ukrainian people who've been, and I know you have a heart for this, Molly, thousands of Ukrainian children have been kidnapped. Tens of thousands of Ukrainian civilians have been killed by a butcher. He's a war criminal. We can't not do anything.
This is one thing I am very appreciative of, that everyone in America seems to agree at least about this, you know, the wrong being done to Ukraine, the horror being done on its people. The question is whether it's better to keep this war. I mean, the way that Americans have been fighting wars recently is to just prolong them for a couple of decades, spend a lot of money, not have a clear strategy, and then after 20 years or so, get out. That is not a good model for the Ukrainian people. The Ukrainian people do have this adversary on their border. The entire approach we've taken for decades has not really been helping Ukrainian people navigate a peace in the surroundings that they are physically in. And so I do think that if you care about the Ukrainian people, the children, the women, the display, you know, what's happening to their men, that you would work, you would work as statesmen to get this war ended as quickly as possible.
Molly Hemingway, always great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you like Judge Thapar as well. It's just such an amazing book. The People's Justice isn't available yet, but Molly, very rare to find two people who've read the same unpublished book.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.